Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the podcast today. It's the weekend. Excited about that. I know that you are. And we're coming down to the wire in all of these campaigns and elections. And I know you'll be probably glad to stop watching all those ads on TV and getting all that mail in your mailbox from all the different candidates. But it sure has been interesting, to say the least. And you know what? You can look back on this and you can tell your grandkids, well, back in 2016, I'll tell you about a presidential campaign that you won't believe. So anyway, what is interesting, and we're glad you're listening, by the way, and we'd love for you to follow us on Twitter at WhatMattersNC. You can interact with me at Mark Shiver, and had a parody account trolling me early this morning, so that was kind of fun. I guess you're making a difference when somebody starts to troll you, right? Is that the way that works? But so engage with us on Facebook, too. We're getting a lot more activity there. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/WhatMattersNC. And you can stay up to date, be informed, and know what matters. So who do you believe? The polls are all over the place. Now, I'm looking at a poll right now. It says CNN, and it has, CNN poll finds shrinking lead for Clinton in New Hampshire. So you have that. And then here's another post, 52% for Clinton, 38% for Trump. Now that's CNN also, and it doesn't say exactly where they are, if that's a national poll or whatever, but polls are all over the place. And interesting read at, the name of this group is Americans for Limited Government. And their website is netrightdaily.com. And they've got this big old article here that says presidential race tight in Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina amid Trump surge. And they quote four state polls by Axiom Strategies Remington Research Group. And frankly, I've not heard of them, so I don't know how reliable their polling is. But in this article, they say that in a poll conducted between October 20th and 22nd, Trump was ahead of Hillary Clinton in North Carolina, 47-44, 46-42 in Ohio, Clinton ahead in Pennsylvania, 45-42, and in Florida, things are all tied up at 46. Now, folks, if you have seen any headlines from the mainstream media, you know, like here in North Carolina, early voting, typically more Democrats vote early. And so, you know, as opposed to that being the story, more Democrats are voting before Republicans in the early voting. No, it's Hillary trouncing Trump in North Carolina, Hillary rolling over Trump in Florida. And, you know, I believe, and we talked with Susan Myrick about this, that this is just the media trying to influence you and me not to go vote. Well, heck, you know, if she's trouncing, we just won't go vote. I ain't gonna stand in that old line and, you know, if it's over, why should I do that? And I find that irresponsible, but, you know, that's my opinion. You probably agree, or maybe you hadn't really thought about it. And by the way, I'm going to talk with Tim Boyum today about that. He's a member of the media, and I guess in some way, so am I. But I think it's irresponsible to try to influence psychologically or, you know, subconsciously whether people want to go vote by announcing that because the early voting is taking place and because more Democrats may have so far voted than Republicans. Oh, well, you know, Hillary is just pounding. It's over. Hillary is now looking to appoint her cabinet. Hillary is, you know, she said, you know, I'm not even thinking about Trump anymore. Well, I don't know who to believe. I mean, do you believe the Axiom Strategies Remington Research Group? Because their point, and this is an excellent article, by the way. You ought to go to netrightdaily.com and read this. They're talking about how incumbents typically don't have the strength in some of these states, and that there are a lot of undecideds in Pennsylvania and Florida. And so here's a quote. If Trump gets the challenger treatment and his supporters remain fired up, he could overperform what he's showing in the polls right now. And so they're saying that from an electoral standpoint, that these key states, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, are still in play. And that kind of answers the question why we keep seeing both campaigns and the candidates and their surrogates in North Carolina. And we will continue to do so up until probably about a week from Sunday. And then everybody will just kind of tone it on down, and we'll see what happens on Tuesday, November the 9th or 8th. So, but it's interesting. So who do you believe? Who do you believe? You know, tweet at us if you'd like at What Matters NC and tell us, hey, I believe Hillary's winning. I believe Trump is winning. And love to hear what you have to say about that. Well, we got a good show lined up for you today. As always, a little different today. First, we'll start off with Tim Boyum, anchor of Capital Tonight at the Time Warner Cable News Channel. And he's always great to talk about during campaign season. We'll get his thoughts on an interview he had with Franklin Graham and also with Governor McCrory and the acting Attorney General Roy Cooper. And then Todd Gaziano, executive director, senior fellow in constitutional law at the Pacific Legal Foundation, is going to talk about an article that he has coming up in the Investor's Business Daily, an op-ed that talks about how important these Senate races are. And it's not just Supreme Court justices. You know, we talk about, well, you know, when you make your decision who to vote for president, you better be sure to think about the Supreme Court. Well, you know, the president nominates, but the Senate has to confirm not only Supreme Court justices, but also federal judicial appointments. And so good conversation coming up with Todd Gaziano about that. And then David Shostokas, sorry about that, author of a little book called Constitutional Soundbites. And he's taken the Constitution and broken it down in, you know, like 140 character Twitter style. And it's really cool. It makes it a lot easier to understand. But he talks about, we'll be talking about Hillary Clinton. You know, she said in the last debate that she would appoint justices to the Supreme Court that would, quote, best represent us. Now, what that means is that would be judicially active in promoting the social and moral ideology of the left. And sorry, Hillary, do I call her Madam Secretary? I don't know. But, you know, former First Lady Clinton, that's not what Supreme Court justices do. They don't represent us. That's called Congress. They are elected to represent the people. And so brief conversation with David Shostokas coming up, but it's interesting nonetheless. And so hope you will enjoy that. As always, thank you for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Love our lineup today. It's informative, and I'm sure you will enjoy it. Please continue to tell your friends and your family about What Matters in North Carolina. Direct them to freedomactionnetwork.com and or the iTunes Store and Google Play. In fact, you can just have the podcast downloaded to your phone or tablet or computer every day, and that would make it simple and help you to, well, get informed, stay informed, and know what matters. Strap in. Great show today. Tim Boyum coming up. Thank you for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Well, as usual on Fridays, we are very excited to have an opportunity to speak with Tim Boyum. He's the excellent anchor of Capital Tonight. And Tim, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, we can see the end, can't we? A little bit, a couple of weeks.
I guess. I can barely get up off the ground to see the end of the tunnel. It's exhausting. We're the final stretch is here, and we'll see what happens. While in days were numbered, there's still a long ways to go in a lot of ways.
Well, less than 2 weeks. I said 2 weeks, but really, you know, we've only got about one full week and a couple of days. And, you know, that Monday before, I've run for office before, and the day before is just, you just feel like, well, I've done all I can, and you try to squeeze in something a little extra, but, you know, really, by next Sunday, it's probably going to be winding down for almost everybody.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's hard for the candidates and the consultants, A, so much is uncertain in North Carolina, but B, you know, with early voting, essentially every day is election day. So, you know, you got to be on your toes every bit of the day, and you got to be pushing people to the polls every day. I suspect we will have a ridiculously busy week next week. We already know that, you know, Mike Pence is coming here over the weekend. We know that Tim Kaine is coming early next week. We just found out today that President Obama is coming next Wednesday to the state. One would easily assume that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will be returning to the state as well. And the Clinton camp has been bringing in surrogates, multiple surrogates on a daily basis. So, you know, while we're limited on days coming up, it's going to be jam-packed up until the very last minute.
Our guest is Tim Boyum, who does a fantastic job anchoring the Capital Tonight program on the Time Warner Cable News Channel. Now, are people still paying attention, do you think?
Yeah, I actually think they are. You know, I think people are really engaged. I'm not quite sure if it's they're engaged because they're, you know, so focused on the future of this country, or it's just been such a long, drawn-out battle, and it's been such a sensational campaign, and people can't wait to see what happens. But I do think there are people engaged. You know, we've been talking to folks. We went to the fair last week. I actually found somebody that really was undecided, and he couldn't decide whether he trusted Hillary Clinton less or thought less of Donald Trump because of how he perceived to be treating women. So I do think people are engaged. You know, we'll see here down the stretch, but it's all anybody's talking about. So I think they are. And I talk to people constantly, and they're talking about when they're going to vote and how they're going to vote. So as sick as people are of it, I think people are finally happy that, you know, it feels like we're finally here and they're ready to cast the ballot.
Well, you know, something interesting, and maybe you can talk about your own situation there where you live, but really, I have been amazed, Tim, at the lack, and I'm not complaining, but at the lack of direct mail that I have received this time around. Normally, you know, I'm 2 weeks ago, I would have begun my, you know, every 4 year complaining cycle about getting so much mail. But it's just been very thin. Are you getting bombarded?
I am getting bombarded. Some of it is likely because I'm unaffiliated, so I'm getting stuff from both sides of it. But just about every night when I come home, there's about three pieces in my mailbox. And what's really remarkable is for some reason they've decided to go with the 8x14, I think, is the size of it. So it doesn't even, like, fit in the mailbox. It's all, like, bent in half and quarters and whatnot. But I have been getting... almost on average, I would say about three per day. A lot of them are repeats, but I'm getting ones in about the Senate race in particular, and also a state Senate race where I live pretty consistently, and then there's always a significant amount of third party. So I think some of it depends on how you're registered, and a lot of it depends on where you live, too.
Now, what was interesting is you said the size of the mail. The ones that we have gotten have been pretty large, and you know, some of those things, though, they just kind of bleed together, and you don't even end up, I mean, I don't know how many people actually sit down with a mailer and, you know, read through them. They might, if it's got, you know, maybe from somebody they trust or you know, a source they respect, they might read a voter guide or something like that. But I think a lot of the recycle trucks are going to be having political mailers in them in a couple of weeks.
Well, I do think it depends on when you do it, right? I mean, like, now, if I'm getting three or four in the mail, it just becomes white noise like it is with all the television ads.
Yeah.
As well. But, you know, when I was getting maybe one in the mail early on, you know, you can't help but kind of look at it, particularly.
Yeah.
They're much brighter and more interesting looking than regular mail, particularly bills.
Yeah.
And so I do think, you know, I mean, look, they test these things. People... they test the size. They test messages and colors and all that stuff. There's a science to it. But I think there's some merit to the point now where people may be just putting it all aside in one pile, and they may look at it, but probably not.
Our guest is Tim Boyum, anchor of Capital Tonight. Now, Tim, you had occasion to speak with Reverend Franklin Graham recently, I guess. Was that last night or a couple of nights ago?
It was yesterday, yeah.
How'd that go?
Good. A lot of it was what you expect. He was actually a little more reserved than I thought he was going to be based on what I've read on Facebook. But, you know, I was really curious because it's sort of been an interesting year for evangelicals, at least, you know, right-leaning evangelicals.
Right.
And so I was curious to be about what, you know, what should these folks do or where do they sit, you know. And so Graham's not endorsing candidates, but he's really focused on one issue, and that's the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And so he's asking people to consider the Supreme Court is their number one issue when they go to the poll. And he basically asked people to hold their nose and vote for someone. Now, I mean, one would assume, based on Reverend Graham's beliefs, that would be Donald Trump, just because he is obviously, at least one would think, would put more conservative justices on the bench, although he won't say that. But what struck me interesting, too, was I asked him, you know, would you trust Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton to do what they said on Supreme Court justices? And he almost without hesitation said yes, which I thought was really interesting as well.
Wow.
But, you know, so it's interesting, you know, and I also asked him whether they're giving Donald Trump a pass. You know, Donald Trump's had several marriages. He's had his own issues, obviously, with that. And he doesn't think that's the case. But, it's just always interesting to hear these different perspectives on this election, particularly when I think I feel like we've talked less about the evangelical vote in North Carolina than any time I can remember, particularly when it comes to the presidential race.
Well, Tim, freedomactionnetwork.com, your good friend Mark Shiver has been talking about it on What Matters in North Carolina. In fact, I had Dr. Mark Creech on yesterday, and he was very impassioned about, in similar fashion, about the Supreme Court and the issues and his advice. Because I asked him, I said, what are evangelicals supposed to do? You know, they have been adamant that they're not going to support, you know, Hillary Clinton in her abortion stance. But all of a sudden, you've got the videos and the things that Trump has been dealing with as far as controversy and morality and all that. And I guess similarly to what you were describing as Reverend Franklin, he was saying that, you know, as it's the issues are what's important, and particularly the Supreme Court. So I guess there'll be a lot of nose holding evangelicals, perhaps, if they go out and vote.
And what I'll tell you that was interesting, too, is I asked him, I said, do evangelicals have a candidate? And he veered directly away from the presidential race and went to talk about how important it was in state races. Uh-huh. Which, you know, does that mean subliminally that he doesn't think there is an evangelical, you know, candidate for evangelicals at the national level? And, you know, I think there's some, you know, you talk yourself into things. Like, you know, they may not like Donald Trump, but we got to worry about the Supreme Court. And, you know, is that them giving Donald Trump a pass then? I don't know. I mean, it's just complicated for everybody, I think, this election cycle. And I guess the same is true for evangelicals.
Well, this is not something, Tim, that would ordinarily make its way onto your television show. But if you and I were just hanging out at a sports bar watching a game, I would tell you this. So I'll tell you this on my program. There have been, and I don't know if you've seen this or not, but there have been multiple pastors around the country who have all pretty much said the same thing. You know, I was praying and, quote, you know, God told me that he was using Donald Trump to wake up America. And I have seen that in a lot of different, you know, evangelical type websites and venues. And it's really interesting because when I first heard that at the beginning of the primary season, I thought, well, you know, maybe somebody ate too much pizza before they went to bed or whatever. But, you know, it's interesting because, and I'm not saying one way or the other, whether, you know, that God told anybody about Donald Trump. But what I am saying is that I think it's fascinating that Trump has gotten as far as he has, and that he has, in fact, at the very least, awakened a segment of the population. Particularly, we saw that in the primary, people that were, you know, just ticked off at the status quo and the establishment. So, you know, for whatever it's worth, Donald Trump has certainly made things interesting this political season.
Well, and I do think it also raises a number of questions about the strength of the evangelical vote. I mean, who would have thought, you know, when I went to South Carolina in February to cover that, you know, I think a lot of people thought, you know, Ted Cruz would win South Carolina, or there'd be a, you know, split among candidates. And, you know, look, there's less people going to church, that we've seen that in polls.
Right.
There's a lot more people going to non-denominational churches, which there's nothing right or wrong with that, but, you know, it's not organized religion in the same way as it is with whether you're Presbyterian or Catholic or whatever.
Sure.
And I asked Franklin Graham about that, and he did admit that, you know, the evangelical vote is not necessarily as strong as it was. So is this the beginning of the evangelical vote not being nearly as powerful within the Republican Party and the conservative section? or is this just an anomaly and it's a Donald Trump thing? I think that's going to be fascinating to watch as we head into 2020.
Yeah, what was interesting, and not to beat this drum too loudly or too long, but early on, Ralph Reed, who, as you know, was the founder of the Christian Coalition with Pat Robertson years ago and now is the founder of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, he said in several interviews, you know, look, the evangelical vote is, as a block, is still strong. And, you know, he was encouraging, obviously, people to consider Donald Trump. And he made the point that, you know, the evangelicals supported Ronald Reagan, who, if you look at, you know, well, what's right and wrong in the eyes of, you know, evangelicals, I mean, this guy had been divorced and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So he said it's not necessarily, you know, taking, you know, looking for the perfect moral candidate, so to speak. But I thought that was interesting. But I think you raise an interesting question, that what do you think we will see, not just in that particular demographic, Tim, but do you think we will see things continue, particularly with this base that Trump has of people who are just fed up? Is that going to blossom into something else, or is everybody just going to, you know, pick up their lunchboxes and go home and go back to work, and we'll see you in 4 years?
Well, I think that's a $64 million question as we leap towards 2020 and even 2018 in congressional races. I think there will be some that will try to do that, no question. There'll be some candidates. I think we'll see someone like John Kasich maybe try to take on that torch, but, you know, push his policy as well. This is if, you know, Donald Trump loses. And just consider that scenario for a moment. I think the other question is then, if Hillary Clinton does win, what does Congress look like and what gets done? If she wins, the Congress remains, you know, split or in Republican control, you know, I think it's a brutal 4 years, and I don't think anybody feels any better about politics, and they'll be sick and tired of Washington and sick and tired of politicians, and it could be another sort of poisonous climate for politicians. But you know, the other thing is that I think any economist that you'll talk to will tell you we're due for another recession.
Right.
And it's not going to be like 2008 all over again, but that's going to play a huge role into the next president and how they respond to it and work with Congress and create jobs in this country, and that could play a large role in it as well. So I think there's too many factors to really know that, but it's going to be challenging for both parties to figure out who their next candidates are going to be, because there's just, this has been so unprecedented and so wild that, you know, it's going to be challenging, that's for sure.
Well, what do you think about the local races here in North Carolina, Tim? We've talked last week about, you know, any momentum that Governor McCrory may have been enjoying as a result of his being governor. And I don't mean enjoying in a negative way, but the fact that he was out front of the media daily, multiple times a day, dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. And he has seen, according to polls anyway, if you believe him, the race between he and Attorney General Cooper has tightened, some showing him actually easing a little bit ahead of Cooper, but still, I think, too close to call. Has he, for lack of a better word, gotten all he can out of that, and now it's on to something else? Or what does he do in the last 10 days to try to keep that momentum going, I guess?
I mean, this could go for the U.S. Senate race as well. I mean, first of all, yes, I think Governor McCrory had a little bit of momentum there, and the race is tightened to basically a virtual tie. I mean, I think we're in a virtual tie with all the three major races. Someone may have a minor advantage, but to me that doesn't matter. And the reason it doesn't matter is because unless something big happens in these last 10, 11 days, it is now, I don't know if there's anything they can do except for make sure that they get everybody and 10 other friends to get to the polls, either now in early voting or on election day. And so I think it's all about get out the vote effort and making voters aware of them and their race. Again, something could happen. For instance, in the Senate race, if there's a terrorism attack somewhere next Tuesday, that could have an impact on that race.
Right.
But I can't see anything in the governor's race in particular happening that would have a major impact, and it's really about getting your folks out to vote and just waiting. I mean, we're all going to be waiting until the last minute. They've done what they can, and we'll just have to wait. It's going to be fun. I'm glad I'm not the candidate or their campaign, because it's going to be a long, nerve-wracking night.
Oh, my goodness. One last question. You know, people have begun to say that, quote, the media, and I guess to an extent, you know, that would include myself and yourself as part of the media overall. But, you know, we see some in the media, and I don't think you've done this, but there's a, you know, oh, Hillary trouncing Trump in Florida, even though not one absentee ballot has been or early vote has been counted yet, you know, based on turnout. Hillary rolling in North Carolina based on, you know, the fact that in early voters have there have been more Democrats. And so is the media guilty of trying to influence people to not come out and vote? For example, if you're a Trump fan, oh, well, you know, Hillary's pounding him in North Carolina, I'll just stay home. You know, should the headlines be couched differently? I would say, you know, more Democrats are turning out as opposed to Hillary with commanding lead. You know what I mean?
I mean, the headlines could have an impact, potentially, yes. I don't fault the media for covering that stuff and impacting the race because, I mean, look, it's the rise of data, right? I mean, we have more information and people are able to make sense of it in a much easier and faster way than they ever have before. And so I think we have, you know, early indications of how things are happening. It doesn't mean that's an early indication of the outcome.
Right.
For instance, we've seen early voting through Thursday, which, you know, fine. Those are interesting numbers. However, they've expanded to over 300 sites now across the state and in numerous different areas. Each county is different than it was in 2012. So you have to be careful about comparing to 2012 in a lot of ways. And it's still way too early, I think, to know even what the trends are in an early voting outcome. Now, when it comes to Hillary's trouncing him and headlines like that, yeah, I think that's fair to be critical of that. But, you know, people have been critical of newspaper headlines for a lot longer than both of us have been alive.
You think? Well, one last thing I want to get in. You had the opportunity to sit down with Governor McCrory and then Attorney General Cooper, billed as 30 minutes talking about the issues. How did that go?
It went really well. It was fun to talk about things like, I know this is going to sound geeky, but taxes, tax reform, and all sorts of issues. And Earl Rubin struggles with jobs. I mean, it was really good from my standpoint to actually talk about the issues because I feel like we haven't. Obviously, still the headlines that come out of it, though, are, you know, Roy Cooper multiple times wouldn't answer what he thinks about the transgender issue personally, you know, and Pat McCrory is having to fight the same stuff on HB2 and, you know, so is he going against what, you know, we saw Chris Malone in the district putting his own thing out. So, but it went, you know, I enjoyed it. And I hope others did, too, because I think it's important to see issues, even in an election where issues don't seem to matter.
Well, and you brought it up, so I'll have to ask you one more question. What did you think about that Malone thing? I thought that was it kind of made me raise my eyebrows that he'd been, you know, for HB2, and now he's rolling out a mailer. Saying otherwise.
Well, I think a skeptic would tell you that polling is showing he's not doing well or it's going to be a lot closer than he wanted to, and that HB2 is the reason.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you're a skeptic, there's no question that's what's at hand there. I'd love to talk with him and try to figure it out as well because we have not heard much from him in the past about that issue. But it just, more than anything, it shows the issue that these urban Republicans are having maintaining their seats because of issues like HB2. There's been no more clear indication of it, I think, than what we saw with that mayor.
Well, you've been doing this a long time. Is that a good move, bad move? Is that going to hurt him, help him? Flopping,
well,
you
mean,
know, at the end like that?
The poll numbers are telling him that he's getting hammered on HB2 and he's behind, and he comes out and says a repeal, and enough voters get that in their mailbox. Sure, that could be politically a good thing. I think, from a philosophical perspective, if you're a Republican supporter, you're pretty frustrated that you feel like he's going to do whatever it needs to win election. So, you know, it really depends on your perspective and where you're coming from. But it's something else to see that this late in the election, no question.
Absolutely. Well, Tim Boyum, we will be watching Capitol tonight on the Time Warner Cable News Channel. And we hope you have a great weekend and look forward to speaking with you again next week. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk with you.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, we've all been aware for quite some time of how important this election is, both at the level of the presidency and also locally here in North Carolina. Big U.S. Senate race between the incumbent Richard Burr and the challenger Deborah Ross. And voting for senators is something that a little bit more important than you may realize. And to help us dive into that and explain the importance of your vote for United States Senator is Todd Gazziano. He is the executive director and senior fellow in constitutional law at the Pacific Legal Foundation in their Washington, D.C. center. Todd, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, so much has been going on in terms of the volume and the noise on the national level between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton that I know here in North Carolina, some of the down ballot races have had a very difficult time getting the kind of attention that they would like. You know, the candidates want to be able to get their message out. But we do have a significant U.S. Senate race here. As I mentioned, Richard Burr, the incumbent, and Deborah Ross, the Democrat challenger. And you've written an op-ed piece that is going to be running in the Investor's Business Daily entitled "The Most Important Matter Voters Can Affect in November." And that speaks to these Senate races, correct?
Absolutely. Fortunately or unfortunately, there's not a lot that most voters can do about the outcome of the presidential race. I vote in it anyway, but for my own reasons. You know, the Electoral College count may not be close. Most states aren't close for president. But individual senators, and this is the theme of my op-ed, can be very consequential whenever the Senate is closely divided, and it doesn't even matter whether they're in the majority at the time. And the focus of my op-ed is on Supreme Court confirmation hearings, in which individual senators have either helped defeat a candidate, rightly or wrongly, or have helped dispel attacks and helped confirm a justice.
So in terms of historically, I think you've got some nice anecdotes here. We all remember, I guess famously, at least in my generation, how it was a lot of conservatives were just really excited about the nomination of Judge Robert Bork by President Reagan. He was clearly one of the most intelligent and well-versed constitutional candidates for the Supreme Court ever, in my opinion. And yet you describe in your piece how Senator Ted Kennedy basically blew the wheels off of that nomination.
That's right. And Republicans weren't prepared at that time for what became known as Borking. So that hearing led to the verb. And Ted Kennedy, within a few hours of the nomination, went to the Senate floor because they knew that Bork was a possibility, and gave a very misleading, unfair talk about Bork's America. Now, since the Republicans weren't prepared to respond and they thought this academic trained judge would respond, they lost the narrative and they lost the momentum. And, you know, Bork had other challenges, including that he did respond in too academic a way. He had a beard that wasn't telegenic. But in retrospect, a lot of people thought that Kennedy creating this narrative made the difference. But on the other hand, there were the explosive Anita Hill allegations 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And a minority group of senators, Hatch, who was then the ranking member, led the confirmation hearings and questioning and did a fabulous job. There were other players as well. But I think that at the end of those hearings, the public, two-thirds of them believed Clarence Thomas, and 11 Democrats in a Democrat-controlled Senate voted to confirm Clarence Thomas in the closest confirmation battle in over a century. And we are all so much better for the fact that those few senators stood up, did a great job, because Clarence Thomas's jurisprudence has been magnificent in enforcing the original understanding of the Constitution.
Our guest is Todd Gazziano. He is with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he's the executive director there in their and senior fellow in their constitutional law division. So, Todd, I remember very strongly that that whole circus surrounding Clarence Thomas, and it really was amazing that Senator Orrin Hatch was able to, you know, rally the troops, so to speak, to his defense. And had he been, you know, kind of weak and really not engaged in that process, it's very likely, number one, that Justice Thomas would not have been confirmed, and number two, that his reputation would have been sullied forever. Fortunately, the truth was able to come out in terms of the challenging her allegations. And, you know, as you said, he's been a very fine justice, but it really does take a strong presence in the United States Senate when it comes to these matters of confirmation.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were other senators who weren't on the committee who also spoke up and forcefully. And I think maybe, you know, Hatch led the fight and that was necessary, but it was so close that probably every senator who spoke up for Thomas may have made the difference. It was 52-48. Since the Democrats controlled the Senate, if two senators had switched, it would have made the difference. And I recount a few others in the Johnson administration. Senator Russell, who was upset at President Johnson over another matter, you know, was an individual force that made a difference. So this is why I suggest voters in all states pay serious attention to these Senate races, listen to what they say, encourage, by the way, the candidates to challenge each other's comments on judicial confirmation, because this is, you know, probably something that the individual voter can affect more than anything at the national level.
Todd, what's frustrating to me and to a lot of conservatives is that kind of, you know, the Senate and the House these days, even though controlled by a Republican majority, trying to find a good word there because control doesn't seem to be accurate, but, you know, it's kind of like putting your quarter in a laundromat washer and it's either going to work or it's not. And there's no reliability that I see that conservatives can count on. For example, you know, here in North Carolina, Richard Burr obviously has, you know, been there for, I think, 16 years or so. He's on the Senate Intelligence Committee. But you often hear how he has, you know, voted for Obama appointees. And I understand what you're saying, that it's really crucial to consider who we vote for in the United States Senate races. But boy, you know, more and more it seems like that, and I don't mean to besmirch Senator Burr, but just a whole swath of supposedly conservative Republicans have really been letting down those who sent them to office. And frankly, this is why Donald Trump has been so successful, at least in the primaries, because people are tired of this being let down. They're tired of this establishment politics. So, you know, what do you say to that?
Well, few of us are perfect, and if you measure, you know, individual senators against maybe how you think you would have responded, you'll almost always be disappointed. But I did confirm before the interview that Richard Burr voted against two of Obama's Supreme Court justices, the only two that he made, Kagan and Sotomayor. And I think he had very, very strong grounds to do so, and that took some fortitude and strength for him to do so, to vote his conscience on those two nominees who were eventually confirmed. So I think that's a strong record of standing up for constitutional fidelity. I'm not saying who voters should vote for.
Right.
The PLF is nonpartisan, and we appear in the courts, and we can win cases regardless. But I do think that, you know, statements I've seen from Senator Burr do so, that he's somewhat serious about reviewing confirmation issues.
Well, and certainly, again, I'm not trying to paint him in a negative picture, and we're not recommending, you know, specific votes either. But it's just this whole kind of a, you know, plethora of frustration that conservatives have had with Congress in general. And, you know, you're kind of hoping that the people who, you know, you send to office are going to take a stand for conservatism. And some of them are holding themselves out as you know, true conservatives. They're more moderates. But one of the points that you make in your article, I think that is important, is, you know, to realize that it's not just the Supreme Court, but there's a lot of other federal judgeships that are going to be, you know, appointments will be made in the next few years.
That's right. And one thing that some senators are beginning to talk about, I know, is that after the 2000 election and some liberals wrongfully said the election was stolen from Al Gore, they essentially slow walked every single one of George W. Bush's Court of Appeals nominees for a very long time, pretty much for 2 years until the next congressional election. And I don't think that's appropriate, but I don't want, for example, if Hillary does win, I do want senators, regardless of which president wins, to take the confirmation process more seriously than they've done. And there are already the federal benches full of many Obama appointees who are less likely to be faithful to the Constitution as written. And regardless of which president is elected, the senators need to make that their touchstone in deciding whether to confirm them.
Yeah, and you do make a good point that these, well, to really spotlight or highlight the point that you're making in your article is and how important these federal judges are. I mean, here in North Carolina, we've been getting hammered by, you know, three judge panels on the Court of Appeals or, you know, single district judges at the federal level. And so these things are really very important. And I think you make a good case about how important voting for your U.S. Senate seat is in your article.
That's right. And one final thought is the senators generally defer to other senators on judges from their own state. So that's another reason, Court of Appeals judges, I should say, from their own state. So that's another reason why having a senator who takes the proper judicial philosophy into account is important.
Well, I will encourage our listeners, Todd, to look for your article in the Investor's Business Daily and to really, if you could give somebody a one or two sentence piece of advice, and early voting is underway here, as I'm sure it is all across the country, but regarding their choice for U.S. Senator, what they should be thinking about, a couple of sentences for them to keep in mind.
Well, you know, liberals tend to say they want judges who will vote for certain people. Well, that's not what the rule of law is about. The rule of law is applying the law neutrally, regardless of who the player is, and applying the original meaning of the Constitution or text. So look for statements that, you know, whether they are going to really apply the rule of law neutrally or whether they're going to favor certain people. Those are kind of cue words for whether they have a good or bad understanding of what the judge's role is.
Yeah, to your point, I thought it was compelling that in the last debate that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had, I think she made a statement to the effect of, you know, I will appoint justices to the Supreme Court that will represent us. And I thought, well, you know, Hillary, you're not appointing legislators. You're supposed to be appointing people who will, you know, take care of the Constitution and rule appropriately in light of that document, and not people that are going to represent, you know, a certain ideology. So that was definitely something that I kind of looked at with a raised eyebrow. But our guest is Todd Gazziano, and we appreciate you very much for having been our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks again for having me on.
Thank you. Joining us now on What Matters in North Carolina is author Dave Shistokas. He has written Constitutional Soundbites, and it's a book that helps us understand the Constitution and some of the related important ideas that our founding fathers had and presented in such a way in this Twitter world that we live in that we might be able to better understand it. So, David, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's really a pleasure to be with you and your audience today.
So what compelled you to write constitutional soundbites?
Well, the backstory is a little bit that about 6 or 7, I've been an attorney for about 30 years, and primarily I was a prosecutor, and then I did defense work and lived with the Constitution in court every day. And as a result of that, 6, 7 years ago, I was invited to do a Constitution Day presentation at a high school in Southwest Florida. And I started out by asking the kids, well, what year was what year was the country founded? And the first answer I got was 1700. The next answer I got was 1800. Eventually we zeroed in on 1776. And then I said, well, maybe I'll give them an easy one now. And what day was it? You know, and it took a while to get there. And finally I had to say, hot dogs, hamburgers, barbecue, fireworks. And people came up with the 4th of July. And this was a sophomore American history class. And I did 4 or 5 more classes that day, and I walked out of there shaking my head at the constitutional American heritage lack of knowledge on behalf of these young people. And so I determined that I was going to try and do what I could to contribute to curing that situation. Started writing online for an online magazine, and then that became my own website. My own website became a radio show that I did for 3 years called Constitutionally Speaking. And for promos for the show, we did a minute of Constitutionally Speaking. What did Jefferson mean by all men are created equal? I answered that in 60 seconds. What can a president legally do with this pen and his phone? And I started collecting the promos, then added to them, and we wound up with constitutional soundbites that is like 150 FAQs about the founding documents from the Declaration of Independence through the Constitution, through the Bill of Rights.
Our guest is David Shostokas, and he's written a book called Constitutional Soundbites. And I wanted to ask you in terms of how the document, which all of our elected officials affirm or swear that they will preserve and protect. The Supreme Court in particular seems to have gotten out of control in terms of what we call judicial activism. And I don't really think that they are basically interpreting the Constitution as it were, as so much trying to rewrite law and tailor the Constitution to whatever social cause that they happen to agree with. And it's very disconcerting as a citizen to see this kind of thing taking place.
I suggest that it's extraordinarily disconcerting. And one of the reasons for that is that we've abandoned the political process in favor of the judicial process. We are now in the midst of the longest period of time for which we have not provided any amendments to the Constitution. Over the years, when there was something that people were dissatisfied with about the way the government worked, they'd go through the amendment process and literally change the Constitution. Now, since they added the D.C. District of Columbia to contribute to 3 electoral votes to the presidential elections, there's been no amendments in over 40 years, not counting the 27th Amendment, which was an anomaly. 27th Amendment took 202 years to ratify. But not counting the 27th Amendment, there's been no amendments in more than 40 years because we've abandoned the political process for the judicial process. And that's why Supreme Court nominations become so contentious. It is that these guys are now a super legislature. These guys and gals are now a super legislature, and that was never the intention. Courts aren't supposed to be that. In the last debate, Mrs. Clinton said something extraordinarily disturbing when she said she was going to appoint Supreme Court justices that would represent us. That's not what judges do. Judges aren't supposed to represent anyone. Judges are supposed to take the facts of a case or a controversy and then apply the law as written, either by the legislature or, in the case of a constitution, the Constitution. They're not supposed to do any representation. That it turns the entire idea of a fair, impartial judiciary on its head. And so it's extraordinarily disturbing to think about what Mrs. Clinton might do with the Supreme Court. And because we have justices there now that refer to foreign law, you know, that's entirely off the charts, because, of course, the Constitution itself says it's the supreme law of the land.
Well, it certainly is disconcerting that she would say something like that. I guess she thinks she's appointing, or if she had the chance to appoint justices to the court, she somehow thinks she might be appointing members to Congress or something like that. That speaks of a real, it either speaks, David, of a lack of understanding or of an intent to say these people are going to represent the social and moral, ideology that she and those on the left are so committed to, which, frankly, as a citizen, is very scary to me.
It's extraordinarily scary, because the idea that if somebody cannot have their ideas adopted through the political process, they're going to attempt to have it imposed by judicial fiat. This is it's extraordinarily scary, because it's that's why something like Roe versus Wade has been controversial for the last 40, 50 years, because when the Supreme Court makes a decision, they take it out of the realm of politics. They take it out of the realm of having a decision and a free and open debate. They killed debate on the subject. And when you kill debate, then there are other outlets for people that don't agree. And so it's extraordinarily dangerous for the republic as a whole to have a super legislature that has the ability to impose something by fiat rather than work its way through the political system that the Constitution was designed to achieve, the consent of the governed. You know, that's something that's throughout the constitutional soundbites, but people never look these days at the Declaration of Independence. And there's in the book, in Constitutional Soundbites, there are over 140 references to the Declaration of Independence, showing how the Constitution was put together to implement or execute the promises of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, of the inalienable rights that we all possess as just simply having been born human beings. If you don't look at the Declaration of Independence, you can't understand the Constitution.
Our guest is David Shatokas, and author of Constitutional Soundbites. David, we hear a lot about states' rights and how the states ought to just say no to some of these federal things. And I've often wondered about that myself. For example, in North Carolina, they struck down election reform laws, one of which was to have a voter ID. So under the Constitution, what right does a state have? Could a state conceivably say, well, sorry, Supreme Court, you know, we're going to ignore your ruling and we're going to require people to have voter ID? Well, what would happen? Are we going to see federal tanks rolling through North Carolina if they disobeyed the Supreme Court?
Yeah, in the first instance, of course, states don't have rights. States have powers and authorities granted by their own constitutions. People have rights, okay? So the whole concept of states having rights is just, it's a throwback to before the Civil War. But that issue aside, there is something called the 10th Amendment that reserves powers to the states or the people that were not granted to the federal government by the Constitution. And among the things that was mostly left to the states to regulate was voting provisions. And I would suggest that this particular ruling regarding throwing out voter ID contravenes the 10th Amendment itself. And that, in fact, the state of North Carolina should have the ability to regulate elections. Absent certain kinds of things that have been the subject of amendments, i.e., vote for universal woman suffrage, votes for people under 18, you can't discriminate based upon race. Absent those kinds of things, states have broad authority to regulate the conduct of elections. And I would suggest that, yeah, states don't often enough tell the federal government that, no, you don't have the authority to make this decision.
But the states don't really have any fallback position. They don't have any leverage. You know, oh, well, the Supreme Court said voter ID is wrong, so toss that out. And, you know, we've seen, I jokingly said the other day, David, that, you know, we ought to just send the North Carolina General Assembly home and let the Fourth Circuit, you know, pass all of our laws, decide what kind of speed limit we should have and, you know, whether or not bars are open on Sunday, because they are just running roughshod all over the state of North Carolina through their judicial opinions. And it's frustrating to me as a citizen because, you know, where do you go from here?
Yeah, there's been a couple of things. I have a piece on my website that indicates that when the federal constitution doesn't provide appropriate protection for citizens, they should often look to their state constitutions, because state constitutions can provide protections beyond federal constitution. There's a floor that the federal government can provide, but states have the ability to do things beyond that. And I would suggest that, yeah, that an appropriate action for some time, you know, way, way, way back when, Andrew Jackson is famously said, well, John Marshall, the Chief Justice at the time, has made his decision, let him enforce it. And I don't think we have enough of that independent streak left in our DNA. It's still hanging around in the DNA from the revolutionary times, but we don't have enough of it left around for somebody to say, no, you can't do that. And I think that, you know, certainly that same kind of problem has existed in Arizona, same problem as you're talking about North Carolina. And these federal judges are actually imposing, as you said, philosophical, ideological test and not constitutional and legal test. And when they do that, they have acted outside their own authority. And when they've acted outside of their authority, there's, you know, Thomas Jefferson, even Alexander Hamilton would say that they have not acted legally themselves, in which case they don't have the authority to be obeyed.
Well, David Shostakis, author of The Constitutional Soundbite, with good food for thought there. A reminder that whoever the president is not appointing Supreme Court justices to represent us. That would be Congress, Madam Secretary. Todd Gaziano, much thanks to him, reminding us about how important the Senate races are. And, of course, our good friend Tim Boyum from Time Warner Cable News, host of Capital Tonight, always does a great job. And wow, I could talk to Tim for an hour and a half, and it's just like I always say, just a couple of guys sitting around talking. He's very good at what he does, but he's very easy to talk to and breaks everything down in a way that we can understand it. So Fridays are good days at What Matters in North Carolina when Tim Boyum is in the house. Well, speaking of in the house, the brand new NC Gundad show is in the house, and you can find that also at freedomactionnetwork.com. That's where you go to find What Matters in North Carolina and Free to Brew, and also the latest edition of NC Gundad. Look for us in the iTunes and Google Play stores. Also, tell your friends and family and remind them that you can find out a lot and become much more informed by listening regularly to What Matters in North Carolina. Just have it dropped into your phone or your tablet or your computer every day, and you'll be good. Huge show on Monday. We're looking forward to that. As always, thank you for listening to What Matters in North Carolina, and have a great weekend.